particularly in regard to the theme we're going to develop tonight and tomorrow night, you will be challenged and inspired further. Yesterday, we set a foundation for this. I know not all of you were there, but we talked about the great revival that God brought to the particular Baptists, a group of young pastors in the middle of England who really didn't believe they had the resources to evangelize the world, but God worked in them to change their hearts about their theology, to remove hyper-Calvinism from them and give them a burden for souls. And we saw that the theologian of that movement was Andrew Fuller. We discussed him last night, and we saw the breakthrough he made. But Andrew Fuller, as hard a working a pastor as he was really the theoretician of all of this. The man who inspired them to really launch this movement, who pushed for them to do it, and who then volunteered to go, was the plotting genius, William Carey. And you say, what is a plotting genius? Well, that's the theme I'd like to develop tonight and tomorrow night. Lord willing, we'll cover about half his life tonight and about half tomorrow night, although I am conscious of the time, and if I need to go home tomorrow and take out some slides, I'll do that. All right. First, Carey was a genius. Oftentimes, biographies tend to downplay this as though he was an everyman. And then you read his life and you realize that's just not true. That is, he was a genius. And frankly, you and I cannot emulate that. That is, you're either a genius or you're not, and most of us are not. And in fact, I don't know all of you, but I'm not. And there are things about Carey's life that I'm going to present tonight and tomorrow night, and you're going to say, he did what? And that could be the opposite of inspiring for us. We could say, well, then I could never be that, and therefore, what hope is there for me? But Carey was also a plotter. Not a plotter, but a plotter. Right? Here is his own testimony that he explained to his nephew just a couple of years before his death. He said, if after my removal anyone should think it worth his while to write my life, and by the way, 15 or 20 people have found it worth their while to do that, I will give you a criterion by which you may judge of its correctness. If he gives me credit for being a plotter, he will describe me justly. Anything beyond this will be too much. I can plod. I can persevere in any definite pursuit. To this, I owe everything. That is, I don't stop. I just keep putting one foot down. That is, doesn't matter what the obstacle is, I'm going to keep moving forward. It's God's grace. But by God's grace, we can imitate that, can't we? Whatever genius God gives us, and that's going to be a wide scale of gifts and abilities and natural talents represented in a room like this. But whatever the genius is, let us persevere in the work of the Lord. And so you know what my theme verse is. Therefore, my beloved brethren, let us be ye, he actually puts it in that phrase, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. I believe that verse captures William Carey's life pretty well. So let us begin at the beginning. He was born in 1761 in Pollersbury, Northamptonshire. There it is, right in the middle of England. Pollersbury was a real tiny hamlet in the middle of that very dynamic scene of the things we've been discussing. August 17th, 1761. His parents were good Anglicans, members of the Church of England, Edmund and Elizabeth Carey. He was the oldest of five children. And as good Anglicans, they took him to the parish church when he was a baby, and they put water on his forehead and said he was baptized. He was reared in that church. They attended reasonably faithfully. And he later wrote, I was wholly unacquainted with the scheme of salvation by Christ. Of real experimental religion, by experimental, he means religion that you experience, that changes your life. Of real experimental religion, I scarcely heard anything till I was 14 years of age. In other words, going to church doesn't make you a Christian. He was precocious as a child, devoured books. He also loved the outdoors. He loved plants. I'm not going to be able to develop that part of his life. There are a lot of parts of his life that even two sessions like we're going to have, we're just going to have to leave out. But he is going to become the foremost horticulturalist in all of Asia. He is going to be inducted into the British Sciences Institute, I forget the official name, when he's in his 60s, because he's going to be so respected as a scientist, astonishing his breadth. But we're told that he had a skin condition that was aggravated by exposure to sunshine, so that he could only be outdoors for brief periods of time, and no one knowing him as a 10-year-old would have thought he'd spend his life in the tropics. All the biographers mention that, and then they never mention it again. So I'm not sure quite how he lived all his life in the tropics. But he managed. And at 14, he was apprenticed to Clark Nichols, who made and repaired shoes. Shoe shop. I mean, his dad had worked as a weaver until he was about six. In fact, they lived in a little two-bedroom house where the loom was in one half and all the living arrangements were on the other half. But he was six. His dad became the head of the local charity school, which was a school for poor children. And guess what? William was a poor child, so he went there, and he got a very good education. That is, he learned to read and write, but the thought that he would go on for further education never crossed anyone's mind. As a shoemaker, he came into contact with other young men his age, one of whom was John Ware. John Ware was what was called a dissenter, or a Congregationalist, or an independent. He was not a member of the Church of England. He believed the gospel. And as soon as he met his co-worker William, he started witnessing to him. In fact, he witnessed to him all the time. And Carrie didn't really want to hear it, because Carrie was the typical teenager. He said later that he was addicted to lying and swearing, but whenever he was confronted with the gospel, he would say, "I don't need it, I'm a good person." And you say, well, those don't go together. They do for millions and millions of people on our planet. That is, yeah, I sin all the time, but I'm better than I am bad. On one occasion, God actually used events to show him his sinful heart. He was sent by his boss on an errand and given some money that he was supposed to exchange for some services and bring the balance back to his boss. But he got a hold of a fake shilling and substituted it for the real shilling and pocketed it. On his way back to his boss, he's working out this kind of complicated scheme to steal a shilling, which is not a lot of money. And he said, "God, I know I'm stealing from my boss, but I'm really poor. Please forgive me after I do this." Guess what? He got caught. Praise the Lord. All right, whenever I catch a kid cheating, which unfortunately probably once or twice, sometimes three times a semester, I catch a kid cheating. And I always give them the same speech. "Aren't you thankful God let me catch you?" Because if you're not one of his, he'll just let you go right on in your sin and think you got away with it. But getting caught is the greatest mercy God can show us. And for Carrie, it caused him to look into his heart and say, "What kind of wicked person am I that I could steal a shilling from my boss and ask God to forgive me in advance?" Within weeks, here's his quote, he saw more of himself than he had ever done before. Whenever we really see ourselves for how we really are, that's the grace of God. Weeks later, he went to Ware and said, "Would you tell me how I can get saved?" And he got saved. He was now a new man. Right away, he had a burden for people who were not believers. His boss, Mr. Nichols, was not only not a believer, but he was very ill. And he and Ware went to Nichols on his deathbed and led him to the Lord. He became an aggressive witness to family and friends. Now, maybe this isn't surprising. We're going to read about him being this wonderful missionary in India. But he was a missionary long before he ever sailed to India. He was a missionary pretty much from the day after he got saved. Eventually, and this stretches out over several years, but before he sailed for India, which is coming up in a couple of decades, he is going to win his parents and all four of his younger siblings to Christ. He was the first one to the Lord out of his family. God in his grace won all the rest. But he was still going to the local Anglican church. And he wasn't hearing the gospel, but the Anglican church is the in church. If you want to be somebody in Britain, you're in that church. And dissenters are kind of the low people. You know, they're the people that can't go to Oxford and can't go to Cambridge and can't really hold any responsible positions in government or society. And so who wants to be a dissenter? But Ware talked him into attending a dissenters' meeting on February 10, 1779. And the preacher that night preached on Hebrews 13:13, bearing the reproach of Christ outside the camp. Now, without getting into that text and the full theological implications of it, what Carey heard was, you know what? He's right. I'm not willing to bear the reproach of Christ and leave the Anglican Church. I'm not willing to follow Christ into the wasteland of nonconformity. But I am now. And he left the Anglican Church and joined a small dissenters' meeting in Hackleton. While there, he began to develop convictions, and he began to develop a family. He married Dorothy Plackett. She was 5 years older than he. He was about to turn 20. She was 25. You say, well, that's really young. It was really young for him. Most men at the time married between about 22 and 25. It was really old for her. Most women married between about 13 and 16. And she was 25 years old, which means she was already well on her way to being an old maid. And, pardon the expression, I'm not saying it's not God's will for some women to be single all their lives. Praise the Lord when that's the case. But in the culture of the day, it was very much looked down on. And he married Dorothy, and at the time she was illiterate. That is, she signed the marriage license with an X, and she had never traveled outside Northamptonshire. That is, she was just a girl who lived around the farm, and that's all she had ever known. God gave them a little girl a year later, Anne, and 2 years later, Anne and Carrie both got extremely sick. Anne died at the age of 2, and they sorrowfully buried their little girl. Carrie got so sick that he lost all his hair, or most of it, to the illness. In order to present it, he was still in his early 20s, he's 22, so he started wearing a wig. He said the wig never fit right, he hated it, but he wanted to look decent. When he got to India, he finally said, you know what, I don't think people in India care whether I'm bald or not, and he got rid of the wig. And so if you see pictures of Carey, he always looks like that. And that was William Carey as a more mature man. That's the only picture I'm going to give you of him. That's what he looked like. He started preaching at a small dissenter's cottage at Earl's Barton, a little village not far from Hackleton, said, we'd like you to come preach to us sometime. It wasn't a fully organized church, but the dissenters would come together at these different points, and then periodically they would gather together for the ordinances. And so he started preaching about every other week, but it paid dirt. He wasn't going to be able to live on that. So he continued fixing shoes. And in 1781, the year that he married, he was introduced to some Baptists who were in the Northamptonshire Baptist Association. You know these names if you were here yesterday. Ryland, Sutcliffe, and Fuller. They were 7, 8, 9 years older than he was. And they all took him under their wing. And he started meeting with them whenever he could. Now, when I tell you what he was involved in, you're going to say, when did he have time to do anything? But he started meeting with these men and saying, please explain your version of dissenting theology. Because if the dissenters were looked down on, the Baptists were really looked down on. Because at least the dissenters baptized babies like the Anglicans. These Baptists are really nuts. And so he began studying the baptism question. And by 1783, he had become convinced of the Baptist view. And he went to John Ryland Jr. and requested baptism. Ryland baptized him. That service, Ryland preached on, many that are first shall be last, and the last first. Ryland later gave testimony, about 20 years later, that I had no idea when I lowered this shoe cobbler down into the water that I was baptizing a man who's going to become the greatest missionary in modern times. Carey was finally, he was now 22, and he was a Baptist. That's our story up through 1782. I would pause for questions. Let me just say that if this generates questions for you, catch me right afterwards and I'll stay as long as it takes to answer them for you. Trials and development, 1782 to 1792. You with me? He was apprenticed to Thomas Old after Nichols' death, but within a very short time, Old himself passed away, and the shoe shop fell into Carey's care. Now, Carey never viewed himself as particularly skillful at making shoes. In fact, he wouldn't call himself a shoemaker. He says, I was just a cobbler. You know, I could fix broken shoes, but that was about as good as I ever got. But when Old passed away, he left a widow who was Dorothy, or Dolly, she went by, Dolly's sister. And Dolly's sister had four children, and they all moved in with Carey. So until his daughter Ann died, he was now feeding eight mouths on very little salary. So how's he going to pay for all that? He opened a night school in the village for village children to come and receive instruction. And he taught them reading, writing, arithmetic, geography, and everything else he knew. You say, well, how could he do that? By reading a lot. That is, he was self-taught. But he's teaching a night school to make a little money. He's fixing shoes to make a little money. He's preaching every other week to make a little money. By 1784, he's doing all of that. Trying to feed seven mouths. It took a lot of fees to feed seven mouths. Barely surviving financially. And we are astonished to discover later that he was also teaching himself five languages. That is, he was exposing himself to French and German and Spanish and Italian and just eating them up. He joined Sutcliffe's church in Olney. Sutcliffe, one of the three pioneers we've discussed, a pretty substantial church, and they said, you know, you ought to get ordained for the ministry. And Carey said, you know, I think I should. I want to be a Baptist minister. And they said, well, here's how it works. You prepare a sermon, and you preach it, and if we think that you would be suitable for the ministry, we will recommend you for the ordination process. And Carey said, amen. And he preached a sermon for them. 1785, and they said, you know, good try. You need a lot of work, brother. And in fact, the official statement of the minutes is downright unflattering. And they said, Carey, go back to the books. You can try again next year. And it speaks to Carey's character that he said, thank you. I will keep on working. And he kept on working. Here is the Baptist church at Olney, eventually a church that seated 700. He became a pastor in Moulton in late 1785. And you say, wait a minute now, I thought you said he's not ordained. Hey, these Baptist churches were small and they take somebody who's not ordained. But he wasn't ordained yet. He was struggling to learn how to preach. He continued fixing shoes. He continued teaching at night. And he pastored that little church. And the church prospered. It began to grow. His preaching got better. Not every man can preach. That is, you have to have aptitude for teaching. But young men, don't allow one rotten sermon to tell you you don't have aptitude for preaching. It may be, just need to practice. And aptitude can develop. And you can become a preacher. Your first sermon is not the measure of how well you will preach. Now, if you try for 10 years and everybody is leaving the room when you preach, it may not be your calling. But he came back in a year, and there was a unanimous vote to approve him for ministerial service, 1786. A year later, he received formal ordination, and guess who was there? Ryland, Sutcliffe, and Fuller. Meantime, his family was growing. Dolly herself accepted immersion from Carey in the fall of 1787. You say, wow, it's been several years. Yeah, she wasn't just going to do it because she wasn't going to become a Baptist because her husband became a Baptist. To her credit, she prayed about this. She considered the scriptures, she became convinced and was baptized. He had the privilege of baptizing his wife. She bore him three sons during this year. I believe that is an accurate photo of them from the time. There's Felix, 1786, William, either 87 or 88, it's not clear, and then Peter in 89, so they have a growing family. For 4 years, he pastored in Moulton, and he was a hardworking pastor, and it was a growing church. But they never paid him what he was worth. That is, his salary was poor, and he was poor. But they were very happy. That is, he learned to be happy where God put him, even if the circumstances were not perfect. That's a good life lesson. That is, I had this conversation with my son a couple weeks ago, in which I said, you got to balance two things. On the one hand, do not allow circumstances to dictate your joy. Your joy comes from your relationship with Jesus Christ. So no matter what the circumstances are, you can be happy. On the other hand, don't just sit back and wait for circumstances to change. Work. That is, you can make things change. You know, put your shoulder to the wheel. Usually, we are either lazy or we're complainers. No, we don't complain and we work hard. Carey learned that early. And he developed a burden for missions. One of the things you knew about Carey from Sunday school is that he got a map, he read Captain Cook's tours, and got a burden for the South Sea Islands, and he made himself a globe, and he hung it in the back of his classroom, and he started collecting statistics about the world. He wrote all over that map. He wrote stats about populations and world religions, and you name it, he put it on his map. And he prayed over it constantly. And he developed an attitude of humility. I wish I could pause and talk for a few minutes about the personal impression I got. I hadn't studied Carey in detail for about 12 years. And I studied him a long time ago, gave an address about him, had a computer crash and lost it, and didn't worry about Carey for a long time. This spring, I poured myself into Carey, and the thing that hit me more than anything else about his life was this overwhelming humility. That is, with Carey, it wasn't just that he talked himself down. He poured himself into others. And you get a sense from Carey that he never thought of himself as any more than just a servant. Here's an example. I see more and more of my own insufficiency for the great work I'm called to. The truths of God are amazingly profound. The souls of men, infinitely precious. My own ignorance, very great, and all that I do is for God who knows my motives and my ends, my diligence or negligence. When I, in short, compare myself with my work, I sink into a point, a mere despicable nothing. When I compare myself with my work, well, study 2 Corinthians, that is the attitude of a minister. Who is sufficient for these things? Our sufficiency is in Christ. In 1789, he was called to Harvey Lane Baptist Church in Leicester. Leicester was right next door to Northamptonshire. He moved there, pastored that church beginning in May 1789, and discovered that it was a mess. I don't know why he took the church. It was a worldly church. It was a divided church. For the first year he was there, it was constant frustration. And then he gathered some of the godly leaders and said, here's what we need to do, men. Dissolve the church. And they did. They dissolved the membership, and they announced that if you want to be a member of Harvey Lane Baptist Church, you meet with the pastors and you give evidence of your salvation and you can join. And they reconstituted the church, and most of the worldly people said, don't want that, and they wandered off. And it was a smaller church, but now it's a church that is primed for growth. In 1791, God gave them a second daughter, Lucy, and unfortunately she died within just a few weeks. And they had lost a second child. In the spring of 1791, Samuel Pierce, a young friend of Carey's, preached his installation message. And guess who were present? Ryland, Sutcliffe, and Fuller, who were saying, we believe this young man is going to be used of God in great ways. April 1791, Carey, in the presence of a number of ministers, said, do you think maybe we should start a mission society? I gave you the quote yesterday of Ryland Sr., saying, young man, God doesn't need your help evangelizing the world. But these other men were also feeling this, and Andrew Fuller preached a sermon on acting now. And just a few months later, Carey published an inquiry into the obligations of Christians to use means for the conversion of the heathens. Five chapters. First chapter was, don't let anybody tell you the Great Commission was just for the apostles. The Great Commission is for all of us. Believe it or not, that's what most hyper-Calvinists were saying. They were using the Mark 16 account, where the Great Commission is associated with miraculous works, and saying, listen, we're not doing those miraculous works anymore, and therefore the commission is not for us. But Matthew 28 says, I will be with you until the end of the age, the eon. And Carey clearly proved it was universal. And then he gave a number of examples from the history of missions. The story of John Eliot, the story of David Brainerd, the story of Count Zinzendorf and the Moravians. B- beautiful little chapter of church history that said it can be done. And then he took all the data on that map and put it in chapter 3. He said, not only can it be done, it must be done. There are teeming millions. He answered objections. We talked about that yesterday. If the merchants can get there, the missionaries can get there. And then he gave practical advice for how we can do it now. He was never a theoretician. He was always practically minded. I didn't want to say a pragmatist. He was practically minded. We can do this. And in 1792, on May 31st, he preached at the Northamptonshire Baptist Association meeting, one of the most famous sermons in Baptist history, "Expect Great Things, Attempt Great Things." Now, about 40 years later, they changed it to "Expect Great Things from God, Attempt Great Things for God." But that's what he meant, but that's not what he said. And Isaiah 54 is actually a millennial text. He probably made a mess of the exegesis, but his theme was beautiful. The theme was, listen, the glory of God is going to spread across the globe. Let's go do it. Let's go do it. And the next morning, they were about to disband, and he said to Fuller, "Are we yet again going to separate and not do something?" And Fuller said, "You're right, we need to do something." So they formed a committee to discuss doing something. And 5 months later, they established the Particular Baptist Society for the Propagation of the Gospel Amongst the Heathen, October 2nd. That name was shortened, thankfully, to the Baptist Missionary Society, the BMS. Now you've got a missionary society, you need missionaries. In the providence of God, a man by the name of John Thomas had just come from India. He had gotten saved, he was a medical doctor, he had learned Bengali, he had been living in India and evangelizing personally, and he had a burden for India. And they said, "You want to go back under our auspices?" And he said, "I sure will." And then he sent a letter to Carey and said, "You know, I think you would be a great partner." And Carey said, "Well, I'll pray about that." There were pros. He had wanted to be a missionary all his life. Ever since he read Captain Cook's Tours, he said, "Man, I would love to go evangelize foreign people." He had an incredible facility with languages. He knew it. He knew he was not like other people in that sense. And this was the opportunity of a lifetime. If I say no to this, will I ever get a chance? But there were a couple of cons. The church in Leicester was thriving. His last Sunday there, he baptized 8 new converts. It was growing. In fact, they had just taken on a building program. You know, pastors almost never move under those circumstances. And they had just launched a major renovation. And when he asked his wife about this, she said, "Go where? When? Not doing it." She was just then pregnant with their 7th child. And 4 months later, January 9th, the society said, "Carey, you want to go with the Thomases to India?" And he said, "I will." He said, "Well, what about his wife?" "Yeah, that's unfortunate, because she won't go. She won't go." They planned to leave on April 3rd, which means he had about 3 months to talk his wife into going to India. And that brings us to the desperate years. I'm going to go a little bit longer if you don't mind. All right. Dolly said, "I'm about to have a baby. I have 3 children under 7. I've already lost 2 daughters. I can't live in India. I'm not going to India." And Carrie said, "Well, at least let me take Felix." And she said, "Okay, you can take Felix." So he was going to take their oldest child, 7 years old at the time. Carey's plan was to get established in India. And then he said, "As soon as I can, maybe within a year or two, I'll come back and get you." But she was still saying, "Make sure you're right first, because I'm not going." So he took Dolly and the boys and moved them to her parents' home in Piddington. And he got ready to sail away. You say, he shouldn't have done that. This is one of the most vexed questions in the history of the church for me. I believe his first priority was to the ministry God gave him in his home, his wife. And on the other hand, Carey loved her dearly. And when you read his correspondence to her, it was breaking his heart to leave her. And he believed with every fiber of his being that God wanted him in India. This was a very tough call. Now, it's easy, hindsight, 200 years later, to say Carrie should have just waited and waited and waited as long as it took for her heart to change. Fact is, her heart never did change, but as we'll see, she eventually did sail to India with him. They had their farewell service at Harvey Lane. He preached on the Great Commission, baptized 8 new converts. His final sermon in Britain was on Romans 12, 1 and 2, from the pulpit in Olney. While he was in London negotiating the passage, he met a young printer by the name of William Ward. When he found out that Ward ran a printing press, he said, "You know what? You ought to come over and help us," not knowing that what the future held. Carey was fretting greatly. The East India Company, which ran the part of British Empire in India, had a law against missionaries. Why would they do that? Because they determined that Hindus are docile. You win them to Christ, and they become less docile. They start demanding better working conditions and better salaries. Furthermore, when you're trying to win them to Christ, the Hindus get upset about it, and we don't want upset Hindus. So they forbade all missionary work in India. Now, that didn't keep all the missionaries out of India, but it made it a lot more challenging to get there. And Carey was wondering, how are we going to do this? So he went to get some advice from a London pastor, John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace. And Carey said, "What if the company should send us home on our arrival in Bengal?" And Newton said, "Then conclude that your Lord has nothing there for you to accomplish." And then Newton said, "But if he have, then no power on earth can hinder you. Keep plotting. Take the next step." Thomas found a British ship, booked passage. They didn't have licenses to go to India, so technically it was illegal to sail. The captain didn't know that. When he found out they didn't have licenses, he kicked him off the ship. Carey wrote to Dolly, a very sweet letter, but the last sentence is very sad. "Let me know my dear little child's name. I am forever your faithful and affectionate husband, William." That is, she had given birth to another little boy, and Carey was about to sail away not knowing his name. Well, they got kicked off the British ship, but Thomas was very resourceful, found passage on a Danish ship. He went to Piddington and said, "Dolly, please reconsider." She said, "I have a brand new baby. There's no way I'm getting on a ship and sailing away." So we went back to London. They got delayed. The ship was almost out of the harbor, and then they got delayed. And Thomas said, "Let's try one more time." And they headed back and said, "Please." And Dorothy said, "Well, if my sister Kitty will go with me, I'll go." And her sister amazingly said, "I'll go." Now they've got to pay the fares for 5 more people. And they sent out emergency letters to all the churches and were able to raise the money in a very short amount of time. And they set sail on the Kronprinzessa Maria, a Danish ship, in May of 1793. It took 5 months at sea to get there, but it almost didn't get there. The ship was damaged while rounding the Cape of Africa. It took 11 days to repair the damages. Dolly and her sister were seasick for almost the entire trip, although Carey wrote a letter saying, "That actually did better than I thought they would." They had devotions morning and evening with everybody on board, and they finally arrived in the Bay of Bengal on November 11, 1793. But you're not allowed into the British East India Company without a license. So the Danish captain said, "You guys better get off before we sail into harbor." And they put them off in a little dinghy, and they sailed to the shore and let off at a non-port, and they proceeded to walk up the coast to Calcutta pretty much incognito. The villagers were thrilled to see them, but when they arrived in Calcutta, they found out that the Indians there were very not thrilled to see them. The Europeans had made a very poor impression. Quote, "Christian religion, devil religion. Christians much drink, much do wrong, much beat, much abuse others." There's a testimony to live down, isn't it? There's India. I don't have a pointer, but if you're looking at the upper right-hand corner of the map, Calcutta is there, northeastern India, and they had settled. There's a close-up of Calcutta. Right across the bay is Serampore, which will be significant to us. Thomas ends up being a terrible person to work with because he doesn't know how to handle money. If you're going to be in ministry, learn how to handle money. He didn't know how to handle money. He was extravagant with it. Furthermore, he had gone into debt in England. There was a warrant for his arrest. So rather than being a missionary, he set up a medical practice. He spent virtually all the money they had. He hired 12 servants. He hired a carriage. You have to look wealthy in order to get patients. The Careys lived in a small hut on the edge of the city. Dolly, Felix, and William got dysentery almost immediately. That's little William, their son. They and Kitty complained almost constantly. They had a ministry of complaining. Carey wrote to Fuller and said, "If my family were but hardy in the work, I should find a great burden removed." That's a short quote, but you can feel a lot of pain in that. So what was he doing with his time? Learning Bengali and evangelizing constantly. He was in the marketplaces every day preaching. He moved his family to Debada in the Sundarbans, about 40 miles to the east, a three-day boat ride. It was a swampy area teeming with crocodiles, tigers, and large snakes. Sound good? Why did he go there? Because he had farmland. His wife was sick. His sister-in-law was miserable. He had four children under 10 and an infant. And when he got there, the housing plan had fallen through and there was nowhere to live. God provided. There was a man there by the name of Charles Short. Worked for the British East India Company, fairly wealthy. He invited them into his home. That ended up being a blessing. He and Kitty fell in love and got married a year and a half later. And eventually, Carey led him to the Lord, and they became very dear friends. He also met Ram Ram Basu, who was going to be his personal tutor in Bengali and Indian culture. We're almost done. He farmed to support his family. He studied Bengali. He witnessed to everybody all the time. He started a little church, but there were no Hindus in it. British people would come. Other internationals would come. He preached and preached and preached and preached, and no Hindus got saved. When is a Hindu going to come to the Lord? He's now been in the country for 3 or 4 years. And then Thomas showed up and said, "You know what? There's this job opportunity. It's 250 miles north of Calcutta. It's an indigo plantation. You can be a manager and make good money, 250 pounds a year. And Carey said, "Can't pass that up. I think this is a chance to really impact the Indians." So he moved his family 3 weeks up into India, took up residence as a worker there, worked long days, preached the gospel to his workers constantly. And he wrote home saying, "You know what? You're not going to need to support me anymore. I'm getting 250 pounds a month or year." And the missionary, Fuller and company, were like, "What? You're not there to be an indigo manager. You're there to be a missionary." And they wrote to him and said, "What do you think you're doing?" And Carey was really distraught by the letter. And he says, guys, this 250 pounds I'm earning, I'm going to live on like 50 pounds of it and put all the rest back into missions. Don't worry, I'm still a missionary." And Fuller realized then that I can count on Carey and he's going to have his back for the rest of his life. Carey and Peter got malaria and dysentery. Carey got better. 5-year-old Peter died. And that was it for Dolly. Dolly had lost 2 daughters. She had told Carey, "If you take my children to India, they'll die." She lost little Peter. And she became unhinged. She went insane. For the last 12 years of her life, she is going to be utterly insane. She gives birth shortly thereafter to Jonathan, their last child. But Carey wrote, "My poor wife must be considered as insane and is the occasion of great sorrow." I won't talk a lot about this, but she was violently insane. She attacked Carey on numerous occasions. She accused him of adultery. She criticized him publicly. She was impossible to live with. It got to the point where he could easily have put her away in an asylum, and he refused to do it. He cared for her for the last 12 years of his life. But he didn't leave the field. He preached regularly to crowds of 200 to 600 Hindus and Muslims. Dozens would stay after to talk with him after every sermon. No one ever got saved. He was gentle with them. In fact, I've included a quote here. He told his son, "Preach the never-failing word." This very much echoes my brother from France. "Preach the never-failing word of the cross. Do not be above sitting down to the patient instruction even of one solitary native. Cultivate the utmost friendship and cordiality as your equals, and never let European pride or superiority be felt by the natives in the mission house," where Felix was in Rangoon, Burma. Well, as we close. He organized a church in Mundabati. He got help. John Fountain showed up, a young man who had ability and education, had a burden for the Indians, and then Fountain fell ill and died 3 years later, 33-year-old man. Thomas was falling apart, mounting debts, abandoned his medical practice, traveled around with get-rich schemes, and then a monsoon came in 1799 and destroyed the indigo plantation. Carey moved his family to Kidderpore, started trying to build a new life, but honestly, why am I here? He's moved 4 times, he's seen no Hindus saved, and pretty much if it can go wrong, it's gone wrong. Tomorrow night, we'll learn about some turning points. That is, if you don't come back, you're going to miss all the good news.